Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. This is Patricia Camilleri, inviting you to discover what research, projects and events are taking place at the University of Malta. I'm very happy to have with me today on University Matters on Campus FM two academics who are here in Malta for a short spell, and they're on the Fulbright program, the US Fulbright program. So we'll be hearing from Professor Andrew Narwald and from Dr. Timothy Ellis. Just a very few words, a very reductive bio clip of my guest today. Professor Narwald is the Professor of Economics at the School of Business Administration at the University of San Diego. He's at present the Fulbright Professor at the Faculty of Economics, Management and Accountancy here at the University of Malta. He received his PhD from the University of California, Santa Barbara, and an MBA from the Virginia Commonwealth University. He joined the faculty of the School of Business Administration at USD in 1990, and his research interests include housing market economics and consumer financial decisions. Yes, I'd like to know about those. He's also affiliated with USD's Real Estate Institute. He has conducted several economic impact studies for local organizations, such as the San Diego Padres, the Buick Invitational Golf Tournament, and the San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station. They're very different accounts, those would have been. In addition to teaching statistics and economics at the USD, Professor Narwald has been an instructor with the USD's Institute for Project Management and its executive program for scientists and engineers. However, today he's going to be talking about his extensive international experience. But before that, just a few words about Dr. Timothy Ellis. He is at present the Fulbright Scholar at the Faculty of Engineering and also at the Institute of Sustainable Energy here at the University of Malta. His recent professional experience includes being Senior Environmental Engineer at Engineering Science Inc. in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. He then became Assistant Professor of Environmental Engineering at Iowa State University and then went on to become Associate Professor of Environmental Engineering at the same university. We shall, of course, be speaking to him about his many other activities, which I was not able to mention in that very short CV. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
I think that clearly the first question one should ask of both of you, really, is the Fulbright program. Why would you want, as an academic, successful academics in your own universities at home, why would you wish to be a Fulbright scholar? And I know that Professor Narwald has had previous experience, whereas I think this is Dr. Ellis's first experience.
Yes.
So it will be interesting to see somebody who's been as a repeat scholar and somebody who's just looking on newly at this initiative. Professor Narwald.
Oh, thank you. Perhaps I can start with my previous experience. I was a Fulbright scholar at the Sir Arthur Lewis College in St. Lucia in the Caribbean in 2002 and found that it was a very rewarding experience from a purely selfish standpoint. The growth that you experience when you are thrust into a new culture, a new environment, trying to make connections between material that you know well, but with the perspective of your home school, your home environment, and trying to make the translation to how those theories, how those models fit in a new environment is a really challenging and really rewarding way of teaching and making that connection. So from a purely selfish standpoint, I find it incredibly rewarding. And I hope that the students gain a lot from being exposed to those cultures as well. The examples I use in class are primarily driven from my own experience, but involving students in discussions in how particular things work here in Malta, how they don't work here in Malta, how they might work here in Malta, are all very enjoyable aspects of the experience. And I can't, like I said, this is my second time with the Fulbright. I've had other international experiences, and I can't say enough good things about I think the positive things that come about both as in a personal growth perspective, but also as well as the contribution that both Malta will make to me and that hopefully I can make to Malta as well.
What about you, Dr. Ellis? What prompted you to take the plunge?
Well, actually, it was my wife who found the opportunity here in Malta. I've always been interested in the Fulbright program, and it's a great honor to have been selected. I've been at Iowa State University for 18 years now, and with young children, we have five children, and at their different stages in schooling and all, it was always difficult to envision taking time off with the family. So this was really our first opportunity where the kids were old enough that it seemed to be a good opportunity. And being at the University of Malta, especially this time of year when Iowa is under about a foot and a half of snow and the temperature is well below zero, it's a great opportunity to be here.
Well, as we record, it's raining, but certainly
okay.
Not.
I'll take rain over snow.
Not too bad, really. Yeah. Going back to your experience at St. Lucia, it must have been a bit of a culture shock, apart from any differences in the teaching methods and that kind of thing. It must have been quite different to what you were used to, as even as a culture.
Without question. I traveled there with my family, and at the time, my children were, I think, 8 and 10. And where we were living in St. Lucia and what we were experiencing, we were virtually the only white faces that we would see on a day-to-day basis. And that was very different for us and especially the children. California tends to be fairly homogenous in parts, and so that was a very growing experience for them, that if they wanted to make friends, they had to make friends with people that looked different, sounded different, and it really was a challenge, but I hope everybody rose to the challenge and really enjoyed the experience.
What about the actual teaching part of it? You mentioned that you look at and see whether things are going to work in a different situation. The economic situation in St. Lucia, I'm not familiar, I'm afraid, with the island. Perhaps you can talk about the island a little bit.
Well, when I was there, it was a very interesting time. So I was there in the spring of 2002. So you have to remember that 9/11, the terrorist attacks, happened in the fall of 2001, and so tourism just fell off the map for St. Lucia. And at the same time, the EU had decided to stop favorable treatment of banana imports from St. Lucia. So the number one and number two industries in St. Lucia were just devastated. And so they were trying to find an alternative way to grow their economy in tough, tough economic times. And so when I started considering a second Fulbright, I think small islands face a unique set of challenges and circumstances. And not only do they create their own culture and their own identity, but also create their own challenges. And so when I was considering another Fulbright, I was looking at small islands, and fortunately, I saw Malta, and unfortunately, I was selected.
Well, it certainly is a small island, or three islands, really, we have to say. What are the main issues that you deal with in your actual academic contribution to the students' work?
I'm offering two courses while I'm here. One is in game theory. This is a fairly new field in economics that recognized as a separate field. We always, it's been around for a long time, but to formally establish it as a separate course with its own structure is fairly new. So that is a new course being offered here in Malta.
How would you define game theory?
It's looking at the strategic interaction between individuals. So whether it's a cooperative game where we're trying to negotiate towards a mutually satisfying solution, or a competitive strategic situation, perhaps bidding for something in an auction or so forth. We need to understand human behavior and how strategies are formed and beliefs are formed, and this is a fairly formal way of going about structuring our understanding of human strategic interaction. And the other course I'm teaching here is also new to Malta, is a course in real estate economics. It's San Diego, Southern California has long been known for its lead in construction industry and construction industry studies. And I developed the course there. And when I was in discussions with the faculty here, they noticed that and thought that that would be a good opportunity to get the students here exposed to our state of the art in terms of what we understand modeling real estate markets.
Well, certainly here in Malta, it's a very lived-in island. It's not a Mediterranean island with long sandy beaches and palm trees. It's very much a constructed island. I think perhaps more than 20% of the island is actually constructed on. Dr. Ellis, what are you actually doing with the students while you're here in Malta?
So I'm teaching a new course called Solid Waste Management and Waste to Energy. The main targets for this class are the engineering students, either mechanical, industrial. I think we have some civil engineers. And then my son is actually taking the class. He's on an exchange program with the Built Environment, the School of Built Environment. So it applies to his field of study as well. Basically looking at how to manage solid waste, both from the generation to the collection to the treatment and processing, and then looking at different waste to energy opportunities, both with solid waste and also liquid and agricultural and other types of waste as well.
Well, it's certainly a very topical subject for us. I mean, something we, being a small island, of course, we have a real problem with. I hope you've got some wonderful golden bullet solutions for us.
Yeah, I don't know if I have the golden bullet, but Malta does present some unique challenges, being the size that it is, the population that it is, the number of tourists that influx the country each year. Where I'm from in Iowa, land is plentiful, and it's not hard to envision having a lot of opportunities for either landfilling or the whole agricultural sector. Malta is a different situation. It's a very land-poor country. I mean, there's not a lot of opportunities for landfilling and traditional solid waste management options. So things like waste to energy, combustion, processing become more of a practical solution than for the solid waste situation here.
So those are the solutions that you offer, or you people would offer, the alternatives to landfill. What are they? Combustion? What are the alternatives to filling up our quarries?
Yeah, so the goal, even the goal we have in the States, is diversion. What can you divert from the landfill, either to process it, to make what we call refuse-derived fuel, or RDF, and that can be straight from taking it from the trash or garbage truck into an incinerator, or doing some sort of processing. It could be involve anaerobic digestion, where you're converting the organics in the waste to methane gas and carbon dioxide, what we call biogas. It could be a mass burn. It could be different opportunities for recycling. The more we can recycle either at the source or in what we call a dirty stream, we can pull out the metals. We can pull out what we call ferrous metals, which are iron and steel, or the non-ferrous metals, the aluminum, the brass, the tin, the plastics that are in the waste. If we can pull those out and recycle, that presents an opportunity, or even burning the plastics. Plastics, paper, cardboard make good fuel, what we call refuse-derived fuel. So there's a lot of different ways to approach the problem, and probably not one solution is going to provide the magic bullet, but it'll be a combination of techniques that we can minimize what goes to the landfill. Still, at the end of the day, we're going to have either ashes from the incinerator,
yes,
or some what we call rejects from a recycling operation that we're going to have to ultimately dispose in a landfill. But using these other techniques, we can minimize that volume to maybe 10 or 15% of what we're landfilling today.
I remember seeing a program on television about an incinerator, a very state-of-the-art incinerator in Germany, which they've sort of hidden in a forest, but it provides electricity for the town, the nearest town.
Uh-huh.
But it does produce a byproduct, which in Germany is used as the base for road building, I think, if I remember rightly, some sort of ash, gritty ash.
Uh-huh.
But I can imagine here, I mean, you know, there's a limit how many roads you could build in Malta.
Yeah.
So you'd have to get rid of it somehow.
Usually there is a residue that ultimately would be best placed in a sanitary landfill that has environmental protection built into it.
Mm. What about the students? I'm interested to see whether the students, I mean, you said you've been at university for a long time at home, and you must have had a lot of experience with lecturing. How do you find our students? I know that you're not going to want to be rude about our students.
No.
But the different styles of teaching, do you find that you have to change your style of teaching?
I guess the presentation here is a little bit different than what we would do in the States, but I find the students here very engaging and very interested in the topic. So I'm actually enjoying interacting with the students.
Do you find that they ask questions? Because we sometimes criticize our own students because they don't have the culture of asking questions.
Yeah, so far it's been good. I have a good size class. I have about 20 students, 18 to 20 students, which is a nice size for that interaction. I find even in the States when you get much above 30, 40 students, then it becomes a big lecture and everybody gets a little bit more timid and less likely to.
Do you allow people to work on their laptops and behind the screens at your lectures, or do you insist that they participate and close their laptops?
So far, that hasn't been a problem. I do have lectures in the States where students will take a nap during class, and I wonder why they even bother. But
that's the normal curve of students in a class, isn't it? Really?
So far, that hasn't been an issue here.
What about you, Fesnawald? The teaching styles that you had to use perhaps at St. Lucia, and the difference between the St. Lucia students and the American students and our students?
Well, I'm still figuring out the system here, but I think I'm very fortunate in the two classes I'm offering are to fourth-year honors economics students. So they are well-versed in the fundamentals. They are solid, good students. I will throw out a suggested topic, and they nod. They seem to indicate that they have that. In general, they do seem a little quieter than I'm used to. I've got a class of about 15 and a class of about 10, I think. But the interesting thing is I have, in each class, I have one of the lecturers sitting in who had never been exposed to the material and asked before I started if I would mind if they sat in. So I'm having a lot of fun with the lecturers in there because they're giving me a great perspective on both what the students should know and their but I think that might also inhibit the conversation a little bit. You don't want to say something in front of so I wish there were a little bit more conversation, but I did have spent a semester abroad teaching in Galway, Ireland, National University Ireland, Galway. And there, the unwritten rule was a student never talked to a professor. Even if you were walking down the hallway and ran into each other, you didn't say a word. So I was a little afraid coming here that student interaction would be a challenge. But I think, especially with the small classes, they're generally stepping up. So.
I wonder why the Irish students had that culture. It seems rather un-Irish, actually, because the Celts are usually quite communicative.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I would talk to my colleagues about it, and they just shrug their shoulders and say, that's the way it is. I do remember teaching one class where a student finally raised their hand. I was very proud of myself. Yes, a comment. And it was either they couldn't understand my accent or they couldn't read my writing on the board, one or the other. But
what a disappointment.
Yeah. So there was my victory was squashed.
So Galway was one of your experiences. How did you come to go there, and how did you find Galway? It's a beautiful county.
I've been very fortunate at the University of San Diego. For it's a small private Catholic school. It actually is either number one or number two in the country for students having experiences abroad. So we're fairly affluent students that go to USD. A lot of them are going for overseas experience. So the administration's very supportive of overseas adventures of different types. So I get a sabbatical every 7 years. Every 7 years, my wife and I have said, let's take advantage of that and do something overseas. And so between the Fulbrights, the semester in Galway, had the opportunity to teach for a semester on a cruise ship that was going around the world with 700 students. It was really an interesting experience. Going to breakfast with my kids, and my students were showing up in their PJs for breakfast. And not a typical learning environment, but a fascinating, wonderful experience.
What was the cruise? What was the aim of the cruise? I mean,
the aim of the cruise is a semester. It's called Semester at Sea. It's a semester abroad, but you are hitting a port We think we hit 10 ports, 10 countries in 90 days. So we went China, Vietnam, India, Kenya, South Africa, Venezuela. So, and the idea was that when we get to these ports, we would then have excursions with the students to look at, for example, I was teaching a course in environmental economics. So we would look at recycling in Vietnam, or we would look at environmental tourism in South Africa. And so we were able to see the applications from our classroom. We'd actually be able to go out into the country and kind of see those applications. So it was a very valuable experience, and who wouldn't want to cruise around the world?
Absolutely. Sounds really delightful. What about rough seas? Did you ever find yourselves in rough seas?
So now, if you really want to see something scary, go, if you Google semester at sea, rough or rogue wave, we were on the cruise where a rogue wave hit us, and we were stranded in the North Pacific in January. My wife, kids, and I sitting in our life jackets thinking, oh my gosh, we are in serious trouble. Fortunately, we were able to limp into Hawaii and everything was okay, but my wife is still a little queasy about getting back on a big boat.
I can imagine. I would be too. I'm not the greatest of sailors, and the bigger the boat, the sicker I am. I don't know why. Dr. Ellis, I know that you yourself have also, within your work remit, have international contacts. And you were telling me before we went on air that you have a very interesting project on at the moment.
Yes, we actually recruit about 20 students a year into our department from China, from a western province in China called Lanzhou, China, in the Gansu province. It's actually along the Silk Road. So maybe about 10 years ago, the central government decided to pour money into that region of China and improve the educational situation there. And at that time, we were looking to recruit students from China, and that university jumped on board. So the way this program works, students spend 2 years at their university in China preparing to come to the U.S., and then they spend their last 2 years at Iowa State University. And I guess the unique part of that program is it's at an undergraduate level. We've typically had high enrollments from China at the graduate level, but this was the first program, at least at Iowa State University, where it incorporated undergraduate students. So that's been fun. I've had the opportunity to go to China about once a year for the past 8 or 9 years and recruit students.
What is your impression? Perhaps I should say, what was your impression 10 years ago? And do you think that things have changed over the last 10 years?
Yeah, maybe more dramatically since my first trip to China, which was in 1987 with my wife. We went to Shanghai, and at that time, you'd have about 20,000 bicycles at a busy intersection and very few cars. Going back then more recently, it's just the opposite. Now you have 20,000 cars and very few bicycles. So the country is, I mean, unrecognizable from the first time we were there. Over the last 10 years, they've gone through a kind of an economic boom and a little bit of an economic bust. Maybe you can know more about the economics with your background. But they're still, with the one-child policy, they're still saving money for that child to be able to get the best education, have the best opportunities they can. And some of those students find their way to the U.S. and to Iowa State University.
And culturally, you found yourself at ease in China?
Yes, it takes a little bit of getting used to. I actually studied Chinese as an undergraduate student, and when I had the opportunity to go to China, I thought, great, I'll get to practice my Chinese. Well, as soon as I got there, they all wanted to practice their English, so I never got a chance to practice my Chinese. And even today, they're typically fairly fluent in English. It's very rare to find yourself in a situation where somebody isn't around that can help you out. But it's an interesting culture. Like Professor Norwood's experience, the students there tend not to ask questions and engage. So that's sometimes a little bit of a challenge. Sometimes it's a language issue. Sometimes it's more of a cultural issue. The style of learning is a little bit different. We try to challenge our students at Iowa State to think critically, to kind of solve open-ended problems. In China, it tends to be more of a rote memory type of learning. So that's sometimes a challenge to get students to think differently and think creatively.
What about Abu Dhabi? What was that experience like?
That was an interesting experience. I always kid to people that we tried to live like the natives but couldn't afford to. We were there for, supposed to be there for 2 years. I was working for a consulting firm that was doing the expansion to their wastewater treatment plant. It's unique there, similar to Malta. They desalinate a lot of their water. Well, there they desalinate all of their water. And then they reuse all their water for irrigation purposes. It all goes to I think at the time about half of it went to a racetrack, camel racing, not what we think of typical racetracks, to grow food for the camels. We were there for about a year, and that's when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait while we were there. So my two-year tour of duty there got cut short by the invasion of Kuwait. Being in Abu Dhabi, we're probably safe, but it was not very distant geographically from where Kuwait is. And so there was a concern that if he did decide to come down the coast, we would possibly be in danger. So actually at the time, my wife and kids were in the U.S. on vacation. I had gone back early, and about 3 days after I'd gotten back to Abu Dhabi is when he invaded Kuwait. And so we were a little bit on a state of alert. Actually, with CNN round-the-clock coverage, my family back home was a lot more concerned than we were in Abu Dhabi. So they would get on the phone, when are you coming back? When are you coming back? But that was an interesting cross-cultural experience for us as a family as well. My son David was actually born while we were in Abu Dhabi. They wouldn't give him a citizenship there, unfortunately.
What about Malta? Are we working you so hard that you haven't been able to go around at all? What about you, Professor Nowels? Have you seen a few of the sites?
I have. My wife will arrive tomorrow, actually. So she's almost getting on the plane in the States as we speak. But so I've held off doing the typical touristy things, I think, until she gets here, and we'll do those together. But I enjoy walking, and so I've been on the west coast, or the south coast, I guess, depending on how you look at it. But walking along the cliffs and down along the water, and it's just beautiful out there. So I've been on the weekends, if the weather's been nice, I've been getting out and doing some walking. But we're living right in Valletta, so that in itself is just worth a wander around to see the sights and smells, and enjoying that immensely.
Absolutely. Well, we've run out of time. Thank you very, very much, Professor Andrew Narwald and Dr. Timothy Ellis, for being with us today.
Thank you for listening to University Matters on Campus FM. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il-programm li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġu plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.